versus Botany, case number 2010-SC-377. Both parties ready? Thank you. Argument is set for half an hour apiece. People have to keep track of your time. And please tell us who you are when you start arguing. And just to let you know that some of us have iPads. We have our briefs and our notes on the iPad and our links to Westlaw. So we're not surfing or reading email. And that's what we're doing up here. With that, let's go.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Jones. My registration number is 31044, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. Sound reasons exist for overruling the automatic reversal rule announced in McCrander. The automatic reversal rule provides a new trial where a defendant was in fact tried by a fair and impartial jury. This rule is not in line with developing United States Supreme Court case law, and it departs from Colorado case law, which evaluates other trial errors under the context of harmless error review. And in fact, it equates peremptory challenges with a limited class of constitutional error that constitutes structural error. Now, while states are certainly free as a matter of state law to decide that a trial court's mistaken denial of a peremptory challenge is reversible error per se, this court should decline to do so. This court has always been guided by the United States Supreme Court in these areas. In McCrander, the court relied on Poynter to state that peremptory challenges are one of the most important rights secured to an accused. However, the United States Supreme Court has gone on to say that it has also long recognized that such challenges are auxiliary and they are not of constitutional dimension. In Martinez, Salazar, and Rivera, the Supreme Court emphasized that the real purpose for peremptory challenges is to help secure the constitutional guarantee of a fair and impartial jury. And this court has never rejected the United States Supreme Court case law in either McCrander or in Lafitte based on the fact that this state wanted to provide a remedy under state law. In McCrander, the court distinguished Ross and said that Ross involved a Sixth Amendment right to a fair trial, and because Oklahoma law required that the defendant use the peremptory challenge in a curative manner, there was no 14th Amendment violation, and distinguished that from the facts in this case, or in that case where the defendant was not required to use the peremptory challenge in a curative fashion. And again, in Lafitte, the court distinguished the case of Martinez-Salazar, finding that because in Lafitte we were dealing with whether or not the erroneous grant of a prosecutor's challenge for cause, and the court found that that was different from the issue in Martinez-Salazar, which dealt with the denial of a defendant's right to use a peremptory challenge. And the court went on to find, however, that there was a 14th Amendment due process violation in Lafitte. It did not find error based on state law grounds. Again, as I mentioned, the automatic reversal rule is not in line with Colorado harmless error analysis. These challenge for cause cases go back to Kennedy, which of course was decided prior to harmless error analysis. The criminal rules of procedure were established in 1961, well after the decision was announced in Kennedy. However, McCrander rejected harmless error analysis. Instead, the courts held that there was a denial of a substantial right. However, now when we look at substantial rights, we do so in the context of harmless error analysis. In order to establish a substantial right, we look to whether or not the error substantially influenced the verdict or affected the fairness of the trial proceedings. Here, of course, where the defendant had a fair and impartial jury, there was no influence to the verdict, and the fairness of the trial proceedings were certainly not affected. Again, structural errors are a limited class of constitutional errors, and they must both affect the truth-finding function as well as a case where the impact on the verdicts cannot be rationally determined, neither of which is true in this type of error. Now, in addressing this, we first have to look to whether or not there's any error at all. when this court decided that Crandor found that there was error. However, the court only had in front of it Ross. It didn't have the benefit of the Martinez-Salazar opinion. And Ross left open the broader question of whether or not, in the absence of a requirement to use a peremptory challenge curatively, a defendant was deprived of his right to use peremptory challenges if he uses one or more of those to remove a juror who should have been challenged for cause. And the court there held that the defendant was deprived of a right given by statute, and it impaired his ability to challenge the ultimate composition of the jury. However, then the United States Supreme Court announced Martinez-Salazar, and it held that where the defendant's right to peremptory challenges, those rights are not denied where the defendant chooses to use a peremptory challenge to remove a juror who should have been excused for cause. The court said that the district court's for cause mistake did not compel the defendant to use a peremptory challenge on the subject juror, thereby reducing his number of peremptory challenges. In fact, the defendant had a choice. He could either exercise his peremptory challenge and remove the juror and receive a fair and impartial jury, or he could allow the challenged juror to remain on the panel and then raise his claim on appeal. The court said that a hard choice is not the same as no choice, and found that there was no error in that case. The defendant used the peremptory challenge for exactly the purpose that he should have used it, to create a fair and impartial jury. Now, of course, Martinez-Salazar did not address cases where the trial court deliberately misapplied the law in order to force the defendant to exhaust his peremptory challenges. And there's no suggestion in any of these cases today that the trial court acted without good faith or in an arbitrary or rational manner.
Would you remind me, how many peremptory challenges is a defendant allowed under Colorado law?
They're allowed 5 with an additional for each alternate juror.
Okay. And that's after the judge has passed the jury and has refused to excuse jurors for cause, right?
Yes.
So how does that safety valve, that kind of number, influence or affect our decision on whether this automatic reversal rule is still valid?
I think in the case that we're talking about here, we're talking about one peremptory challenge that the defendant had to use in a curative fashion. The defendant chose to use one of his allotted 5 peremptory challenges to remove this challenged juror that should have been removed for cause. He still had the benefit of 4 additional peremptory challenges to use in his discretion to excuse any other jurors that he felt so inclined to challenge. Now, again, it might be a different situation if the court was denying multiple challenges for cause in an arbitrary way, such that the defendant had no peremptory challenges left to use in a discretionary fashion, but that's certainly not the case here, where we're dealing with one particular juror, one challenge for cause, one peremptory challenge that was used in a curative fashion.
Could I ask you a question about the, I wasn't entirely clear about your argument with regard to the harmless error and then the question whether there's error at all with regard to peremptories. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could explain that in just a little bit of detail. Seems like you've got 2 problems here. The one you're talking about is error in not granting a challenge for cause when it should have been granted. Mm-hmm. And so you're addressing, we're talking about whether we treat that as structural error or harmless error. And secondly, you got a problem, is the defense simply deprived of being able to exercise all the peremptories?
I think that the court's holding in McCrander said that the defendant was denied a statutory right when he was required to use one of his peremptory challenges to cure the trial court's error. They found that that error, or that choice, was error. The defendant should not have been required to use his peremptory challenge in a curative fashion. However, then the United States Supreme Court announced Martinez-Salazar, and in that case they said there is no error where the defendant uses a peremptory challenge to excuse a juror that should have been excused for cause, because he was given the number of peremptory challenges that he was entitled to by statute. He had a choice in the way in which he used those peremptory challenges, And as a result, there was no error at all in the fact that he exhausted one of those challenges to remove a juror who should have been excused.
And that's, and you're asking us to adopt that approach to the question of peremptories and simply find there's no error as long as the defendant exercises the peremptory, even if it's to cure another mistake.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And then with regard to the challenge for cause itself, the error in failing to grant that?
Well, whether or not the trial court erred in failing to grant the challenge for cause, of course, is a separate issue from this. But here we're talking about whether or not we have a 14th Amendment due process violation because the defendant was required to use one of his peremptory challenges, or as is really the case, chose to use.
Well, let's just go back one second, just so I can separate these two out for analytic purposes. The defendant also has a right, both a statutory and constitutional right, is that not right, to have someone removed if there is cause under the statute. And if the judge failed to do that, then that's an error. The first part, it seems to me, your analysis is you're addressing what standard of error we should apply. Mm-hmm. And is that where you're talking about structural versus harmless error, how we should approach the problem of a challenge for cause?
Yes, because as it currently stands, if the trial court erroneously denies a challenge for cause and the defendant exhausts his peremptory challenges, we automatically reverse the defendant's convictions and send back for a new trial without any analysis as to whether or not the error actually impacted the defendant's conviction and the jury verdict in this case. And if you have a situation where the challenged juror has been removed and the remaining jurors are all fair and impartial, then the defendant was not deprived of his right to a fair and impartial jury.
And so, in effect, the error of failing to grant a challenge for cause, the thrust of your argument is, well, that's harmless.
Yes,
as long as that juror, is that juror gets removed, is that perspective?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So then the question tips over to, nevertheless, was the defendant harmed by having to exercise a peremptory to create that harmless error?
Right.
Okay.
And in that case, again, we're looking at whether or not, we have to decide whether or not it's error at all that the defendant chose to cure the error in that fashion by using a peremptory challenge. Yeah,
well, this is a longstanding rule, so we shouldn't easily overturn it. It's governed our practice for a long time. Give me the policy basis for allowing the defendant to, I'm going to use this word advisedly, tailor a jury beyond excusing for cause, to pick that panel as closely as he or she can by simply removing jurors under the statutory basis.
Well, again, I think that goes back to what the purpose is for peremptory challenges and whether we're really talking about the ability to shape the jury or whether or not peremptory challenges really act as another means to securing a fair and impartial jury, which is what Martinez Salazar and Rivera have said that the purpose of peremptory challenges are. And so this idea of shaping the jury or having an equal opportunity with the prosecution to shape the jury, it's something that this court has touched on in McCrander. But again, the rule as we have it now doesn't necessarily create parity between the parties. Take, for example, a situation where the trial court were to erroneously deny a challenge for cause both to the prosecution and to the defendant, and both of those attorneys then use a peremptory challenge to remove that jury. They've each exhausted one of their discretionary peremptory challenges. They each retain four discretionary challenges to use in any manner that they see fit. And yet, under our current rule, we still sent back for a new trial because of this idea that the defendant was somehow deprived of his right to shape the jury. Really, what we should be looking at isn't whether or not the defendant had a right to shape the jury, but whether or not he received a fair and impartial jury and did so by using his peremptory challenges. And again, I recognize that this is a long-standing rule in Colorado. However, I think that the United States Supreme Court since McCrander has been continuously developing. And the court in McCrander didn't have Martinez Salazar in front of it saying this is not an error when the defendant chooses to exercise a peremptory challenge in this fashion. court didn't have Rivera saying that there's no due process right, there's no violation of the due process right when there's a state error in the exercise of a peremptory challenge. So the court didn't have all of the tools that are now available to it when it first decided in Crandor. So again, even if we are to assume that there was some type of error in the defendant's ability to exercise his peremptory challenges, if we go forward and look at Rivera, we have to see that this is no longer a 14th Amendment due process violation, which is what the court found in Lafitte. In Rivera, the court said that a mistaken denial of a state-provided peremptory challenge does not violate the federal constitution. It's a mere error of state law, and that does not deny a defendant due process.
Could I ask you a question about Lefebvre, even though that was a slightly different situation? You several times now have seemed to suggest that Lefebvre was based on federal constitution. But am I wrong in recalling that in that case, we distinguished Martinez Salazar on the basis that it was based on federal constitutional law, whereas we were going to be looking at our state statutory provisions. Am I wrong in that?
Well, that's correct. And Martinez Salazar was distinguished by the court based on both the fact that it was dealing with federal law and the fact, really, that it dealt with the denial of a defendant's peremptory challenge rather than the erroneous grant of a prosecutor's challenge for cause. So it was distinguished on the facts as well. However, since Martinez Salazar, I mean, what the court found was a denial of your 14th Amendment due process right because the defendant didn't receive what state law provides. And we now know that it's not a 14th Amendment due process right if the defendant doesn't receive what state law provides.
Okay.
Of course, the state can create a state remedy, but it can't be under the federal constitution.
Counsel, could I just pick up on your harmless error analysis? Could you give me an example of what would be harmful error? If we do what you want us to do, what's left? Anything?
Well, I think if the defendant were to choose to have the challenger remain on the panel, certainly there it would show harm.
Okay, but has there ever been a case where that occurred?
Where a defendant chose to leave the challenger on the panel? One doesn't come to mind, but I imagine that there could be situations where it could happen.
Okay. And the reason I'm asking you is, in your brief, and we've had a lot of briefing on this question, I think you point to experience in other states that have gone to this harmlessness analysis, but I didn't see a single case cited where it was actually harmful. And that's, I'm wondering if...
I do think that would be one instance where you could find harm. I also think that Rivera left the door open for situations where we have a trial court who is acting in an arbitrary manner in denying the challenges for cause, such that the defendant is being forced to use peremptory challenges, possibly a case where there were more challenges for cause denied than peremptory challenges available. In those situations, that's still an open question about whether that might rise to the level of a due process violation.
Okay. But it's you're saying very, very narrow. I'm putting words in your mouth, but very, very narrow circumstances.
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And essentially, those circumstances would be where a biased juror actually sat on the jury, either because the defendant ran out of challenges or for whatever reason decided to leave that biased juror and not exercise the peremptory.
I believe that would be in most of the cases. Like I said, Rivera seems to say if the trial court's behavior was irrational or arbitrary, even if it didn't go above and beyond the number of peremptories, that might be a situation, but that's obviously very distinct from what we're looking at today.
And so thinking about that as a practical matter, and also Ginsburg's comment in Martinez Salazar about, the defense counsel could have chosen to leave that biased juror and then raise that challenge on appeal. As a practical matter, do you think that on appellate review, how we would look at that if, in fact, a defendant decided to raise a challenge for cause to a juror, but then after that challenge for cause was denied, chose not to exercise a peremptory. And I'm thinking of two cases in particular that make me wonder how we would treat that. And the first one is the Harris case, in which I seem to recall that that was a situation. There was a juror who was challenged, and then the defendant chose not to ultimately exercise a peremptory. And we looked at it from an appellate standpoint to say, well, the fact that you didn't choose to exercise the peremptory suggests that, in fact, the defendant didn't, in fact, object to having that juror sit. And we didn't call it waiver, but we sort of treated it like waiver.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just curious about the position that puts the defense counsel in suggesting that there is, in fact, a real choice.
Well, and again, I think that's a matter for states to decide. There are certainly a couple of states that come to mind that do require the defendant to either use a peremptory challenge to excuse the juror or, in fact, waive the challenge. And I think there was some discussion in either Rivera or Martinez Salazar, possibly in a concurrence, discussing that idea as well, that possibly, I believe it was Martinez Salazar, that we shouldn't even be addressing this because it's possible that it was waived. Again, the people are not suggesting that that would be an appropriate remedy here. We're not advocating for a position where the defendant is forced to exercise a peremptory challenge or waive that challenge. So if the defendant were to choose to leave the juror on the panel, then this court or the Court of Appeals would evaluate that juror just like it does a challenge for cause now to determine whether or not the challenge was properly denied. And if not, if the juror should have been excused for cause and did sit, then the defendant would be able to establish harm.
Could I ask you about this case, though? Do you think it was error at all to deny the challenge for cause?
Regarding whether or not the challenge juror was a compensated employee of a public law enforcement agency?
Right.
No. I don't think that it was a error to deny the challenge for cause. I don't think that the Attorney General's office is a public law enforcement agency. Of course, this court has defined public law enforcement agencies as police-like divisions of government that have the authority to investigate crimes and arrest and prosecute and detain suspects. But an employer does not become a law enforcement agency simply because certain employees perform law enforcement functions. The primary purpose of the agency has to be criminal law.
Ms. Jones, can I?
Yes.
Good morning. How does the trial court make a determination during voir dire what the primary purpose of an agency is?
Well, this court has held in Speer that unless there is a statute identifying the agency as a public law enforcement agency or public case law identifying the agency as such, then the court cannot be expected to know whether or not an agency is a public law enforcement agency without adequate evidence in the record before it.
So you say there needs to be case law. How does that get developed? I mean, I'm picturing a trial court. You have one person there. There's no basis to make evidentiary findings about percentages or functions or whatever it may be.
And that's exactly the problem with finding an abuse of discretion in this case, because when the juror was questioned, the only questions that were asked of him were regarding his own personal duties. Nothing was asked regarding the Attorney General's office as a whole, what the primary purpose of the agency was. There wasn't anything presented by the defendant to show that this agency had been described as a public law enforcement agency in either the statute or case law. And so the court, of course, is left to say, well, I have very limited knowledge of the Attorney General's office. What I know is that the Attorney General's office does multiple things. I don't think that their primary purpose is law enforcement, so I'm going to deny the challenge. And the defendant at no time attempted to put any information in front of the court regarding the functions of the Attorney General's office.
So we shouldn't decide in this case the generic question. We should stop right there, say that the defendant didn't meet the burden?
Yes, it's the defendant's burden, and if not, he's waived the challenge. So the defendant needed to come forward with some evidence regarding the primary purpose of the Attorney General's office, whether that be testimony from the juror, statute, case law, something along those lines. And in this case, defense counsel did nothing to give the court any guidance regarding the primary function of the Attorney General's office.
Counsel, could I follow up on that just a moment? Did we not say in Ma and again in Speer that the Attorney General's office, we listed the Attorney General's office among a list of other law enforcement type agencies? Is that correct?
Yes, and that was with respect to certain statutes that talked about the Attorney General's office as a law enforcement agency.
And going back to your original statement, which said, unless there's, you know, the statute identifying the agency as a law enforcement agency or case law out there identifying the agency as a law enforcement agency, then these are the kinds of things the trial court would rely on. But it seems to me that at the time of the Bottoms trial, that very information was at least out there. I mean, those statutes certainly existed. And
those statutes certainly did exist. And again, those were very specific statutory provisions dealing with location information for individuals with outstanding felony warrants. And as I talked about in my brief, there are multiple other statutory sections that differentiate between law enforcement and the Attorney General's office, saying law enforcement or the Attorney General's office.
But there's at least some of those, I know there's a long list of statutory references, but at least some of them clearly say law enforcement agency is defined as including the Attorney
yes.
General's office. And it's scattered throughout. So the General Assembly, in several respects, has deemed the Attorney General's office as a law enforcement agency.
Well, and again, all of those are somewhat similar statutory provisions where the Attorney General's office is defined as law enforcement. But again, as I said, there are multiple other provisions that were also available to the trial court that seems to pull the Attorney General's office out as something other than law enforcement. And so at best, the statutes were ambiguous, and how is the court to know without any additional evidentiary or any additional evidence before it whether or not the primary purpose of the Attorney General's office is a law enforcement agency when the only statutes available in some ways contradict each other?
Well, this has to be a criminal law enforcement agency. Obviously, the Attorney General's office throughout is a law enforcement agency. It's
even
in its civil capacity.
Yes. This provision for a challenge for cause has been limited to the enforcement of criminal laws.
But what about the idea that if you're in that same office and you have a group that's either cross-deputized to do prosecutions, as sometimes the Attorney General's office does with these special units, or a wholly dedicated group to arguing criminal appeals, doesn't that intimate that you'll sort of stand together with your colleagues and therefore it's inappropriate to have an Attorney General serve in a criminal case?
No, I don't think so. And I think that, again, we've talked about the fact that an employer does not become a public law enforcement agency simply because certain employees perform law enforcement functions. And when you look at the multiple functions that the Attorney General's office has, criminal enforcement is a very small section of the office. And again, the power that the Attorney General's office has to enforce criminal laws and to engage in prosecution is limited by the power vested upon it by the governor. So, other than, of course, appeals, which is listed in the statute, but as far as the prosecution function goes, that's limited by what the governor says. And we've had other cases where we've had both civil and criminal. The EPA, for example, they have both, and the court decided that that was not a law enforcement agency.
Counsel, before you're almost out of time, so let me just ask you, if we decide against you on this preliminary question, we say law enforcement agency through and through, what happens to the case from under your theory?
Well,
what would you like to see us do at that point?
Well, then at that point, we go back to the fact that the defendant utilized a peremptory challenge to remove this juror. So this juror did not sit, so the defendant had a fair and impartial jury. So this court should reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you.
If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve my limited time for rebuttal.
You may.
Thank you. May it please the court, Karen Garash on behalf of the Public Defender's Office representing Martin Novotny. So the government's contention again is that if a defendant has a fair jury, meaning a jury upon which no jurors challengeable for cause sat, then no harm, no foul. This precise argument has been rejected by this court twice now, once in Kennedy and then 80 years later in McCrander. In McCrander, this court specifically, unanimously said that that reasoning was unassailable and applied with greater force in a felony prosecution. McCrander's been in existence for 20 years or more now. Neither the statute has changed nor anything else relevant to that decision has occurred to call that decision into question. The issue here really is a defendant has a constitutional right to an impartial jury. Challenges for cause go to preserve that right. It is a trial court's duty then to excuse all valid cause challenges. For that violation, a defendant has and always will have a constitutional remedy. That is not what McCrander addresses. What McCrander does is defines harm and provides a remedy for a trial court error on challenge for cause rulings that result in the impairment of a substantial right. And when that substantial right is impaired, harm results and defendant gets the remedy. Under McCrander, you are not necessarily going just for this baseline, no cause challengeable jury. You have that substantial right to use those challenges based upon your perceptions, which of course are going to change in any individual.
So you have to characterize the Colorado statutory right as a substantial right.
Yes.
So how do we figure out in other applications of that doctrine whether something provided by the legislature is a substantial right?
The broad rule is characterizing something as substantial creates vested rights are matters of public policy versus procedural rights, which really just enhance the working of the court, make it easier for the court to do its day-to-day duty. This court has said it's a substantial right because it recognizes both the functions of both statutes. It makes sense to say it's a substantial right because otherwise it doesn't have any teeth. It doesn't get you where you need to be. The rule as we know it now recognizes challenge for cause, trial court duty, impartial jury. Peremptory challenge is a substantial right to get more than that. You get to use your peremptory challenges in a certain number with parity, and you get to do that to pick a jury that is comports with your perception.
I guess what I'm having trouble with is then the harmless error rule is substantially undercut. Once you find there's a substantial right, harmless error does not apply, right? Doesn't that follow from your argument?
The harmless error results when the trial court error results. When the trial court error in excusing a juror for cause, he should have excused one, he didn't. Now, defendant is denied one challenge. He can waive that error. He can either not excuse that juror or he cannot exhaust. But where he does, that substantial right to shape that jury according to the statute and on par with his adversary has been impaired. It is the impairment of that right that results with you secure plus exhaustion that this court has held for the past century.
Can I just ask you a question? I mean, your argument obviously makes sense, and it is consistent with what we have done in Colorado. I'm sorry, I'm not talking very loud today. It's unusual. Your argument makes sense, and it's consistent with what we've done in Colorado. There's a logic to what you're saying. Why do you think the United States Supreme Court just rejected that? What's going on in that case?
Because they're addressing a different right and a different remedy.
So tell me how we would distinguish that case. I know we don't have to follow it, but tell me how we would distinguish it if we were to write an opinion affirming our perspective.
Distinguished Martinez-Salazar?
Yes, other than just on state constitutional grounds.
Yes. My argument to you is that Ross, Martinez-Salazar, and Rivera have absolutely no relevant bearing to our state law decision.
Could you tell me about that, please?
Yes. Martinez-Salazar said, there is no Sixth Amendment violation where your right to an impartial jury has not been violated. Fine, that we accept that, because you have your Sixth Amendment jury. They said there is no rules violation under Federal Rule 24 if you use your peremptory challenge to cure. You don't have to, but if you do that, okay, that's fine. It makes sense under the federal rule because that's the means to the end. It's you get your Sixth Amendment jury, end of story. However you get there, you can use your peremptories, you can use your cause challenges. We have a different system. We say, no, you get cause challenges granted where they are valid, period, mandatory. Second, then parties, you have an independent right to use your peremptories. Under the feds, there's that federal rule also initially provides more for defendants. So presumably anticipating a use to get to that end, the only end in the federal system.
How does the federal rule initially provide more?
The federal rule provides defendants start, I believe, defendants start with 10, prosecution starts with 6. So if you use to cure, then
well,
it's not a system of parity.
There's no right to talk to the jurors in federal court, period, for the lawyers to talk.
Which
and
the
most
system
federal courts
advocating.
Don't permit defense lawyers or prosecutors to question the jury.
So the system they're advocating would more or less eliminate the need for that here too, because if the only end you're seeking is the baseline Sixth Amendment right, and we don't care about the perceptions and we don't care about the individual right to shape it, then you just can check off those challenges for cause. Peremptory challenges then no longer are a substantial right to be used to enhance that balanced and impartial jury. But they're a safety net.
Sure, I get what you're saying. But isn't the logical extension of that argument that in if we were to apply a state court analysis, that in federal court you get 4 peremptory challenges to correct badly made decisions for cause, and then you get the rest of your challenges to make you equal with the prosecution? That's sort of what you're saying. And so what if the differential between the defendant and the prosecution in federal court was 4, 10 versus 6, and there were 5 bad challenges for cause that should have been granted that weren't in federal court? Wouldn't we be in exactly the same kind of state system, the state problem, state dilemma we have right here?
I think, really, Your Honor, what that highlights is why would we change it then?
But what I'm saying is I'm sure the United States Supreme Court must have thought that through. So, assuming that they did, what is the logic, what is the jurisprudence which would explain the difference conceptually between the way we approach it and they have approached it, other than these differences in how juries are selected, which frankly change.
So if I understand your question.
In my lifetime, they've changed quite a few times.
I'm not sure I do understand your question. If I understand your question, please. You're saying if the federal court ultimately comes back around to parity, then.
Well, maybe I misunderstood what you said, but what I thought I understood you to have said was that one of the ways that we can distinguish the way the federal system looks at jury selection and the state system looks at jury selection is there is a built-in corrective mechanism, if you will, between the prosecution and the defense and the Fed system in that in the federal court, defense counsel gets more peremptories than prosecution, right? And is that's the first thing. And then the second, if that's correct, then the second thing is that in that differential, say 4, if it's 10 to 6, allows a defense counsel to eliminate jurors who should have been excused for cause and still maintain that parity with the prosecution, if you will, to have a fair jury, and therefore there's no harm. Right. Are you with me so far?
I think so.
Okay, so then the next problem, where I'm trying to go is, but what, imagine a situation where the federal judge made more than 4, 5, 6, 7 errors with respect to challenges for cause. Well, then you lose that built-in rule advantage, if you will, and we're right back to where the state system is. Mm-hmm. So what jurisprudentially is the difference?
So if the federal rule gives you more...
Mm-hmm. To correct that very problem, ostensibly.
Ostensibly. I don't know why they give you more. Maybe the feds give you more just because they don't really care about parity, which we do. But the denial in our system comes when the error occurs, and not only are you denied the parity, but you are denied that challenge to use for this purpose. So it's not just the number that I'm being given, but it's the number and the purpose. And the purpose under our system is to get more than that baseline jury. And the feds don't have that purpose.
Counsel, I'm sorry, I'm just going to ask you to repeat that one more time. You're saying the two systems have different goals. I mean, under the federal system, where the Supreme Court has only said you need a fair and impartial jury, that's a very, I guess, in your view, a very limited goal, a limited purpose. Whereas our system is built up certainly to further that, but there's an additional component, which is that sort of, I have this many and I didn't get it. I wasted one, or I was forced to use one. Is that what your...
Yes.
That's your argument.
Yes. And you seem critical.
No. No, I'm just trying to get you to articulate. I'm just following up on what Justice Rice said. I'm trying to get you to articulate more how our state statutes provide some sort of additional, more robust... Right, that I'm trying to get you to articulate more.
Let me see if I can offer you an example. Under the government's proposed rule, if you use securities of no moment because you're getting your impartial jury, well, under our system, it's a great moment because, yes, I may be getting my impartial jury for which I have my constitutional remedy. But what I am not getting is the process that is required to get me there that protects both my right to use my challenge and my right to use it equally. It matters greatly under our system if defendant has to use his challenge to secure that impartial jury versus the trial court doing its job to grant the challenge and get us there so that the peremptories are free to be used as they are intended. Under the federal system...
Ms. Goresh, I'm sorry to interrupt you. But let me come at it from a slightly different direction because this is obviously something that interests us. So what if we changed by rule here in the state the number of peremptory challenges that were afforded to the defense and made it more than the number of peremptory challenges that were awarded to the prosecution, much like the federal system, mm-hmm. which I suppose we could do? We would then be in line with federal precedent, wouldn't we?
Well, it depends then on how you define how you're going to use those additional challenges.
Well, if we adopted the federal rule, mm-hmm. said we're going to handle peremptory challenges exactly like they do in the federal courts, which we could do, would that obviate the constitutional issue? All right, now that's what I want you to drill into, if you would, please.
Okay. Peremptory challenges are not a constitutional right, but nor are they, under our system, a means to the Sixth Amendment end. Under our system, when you have to use, or when a trial court errs, and a defendant uses that challenge and exhausts, then there is an error in the process that affects a substantial right for which there is a state court remedy. So if you're going to go under the federal system with the use to cure, well, first of all, it depends. Do you have to cure or can you cure? Because if you have to cure, then really you've obliterated the distinction between cause and peremptory challenges. Peremptory challenges then are just a safety net for trial court errors. And the only harm you have is when you get to the end of the trial, if you've exhausted everything available to you and then a trial court errs, then you have a constitutional remedy. If you're permissibly using to cure, meaning you can go ahead and correct, but you don't have to, then I think you have this question of waiver of remedy that comes up.
Well, I suppose if you didn't use one of your peremptory challenges, it would be maybe invited error, and then you could get in all sorts of problems. But I'm not sure that I still am understanding where jurisprudentially or more specifically constitutionally the difference comes. If you assume that we were to change the state system so it's exactly the same as the federal system, what constitutionally, by rule, what constitutionally would be the difference? And what are you pointing to?
Constitutionally, nothing.
Okay.
But what you're removing is the state remedy. So constitutionally, then you're just saying, okay, all we care about is this means to an end. Get us to this Sixth Amendment jury. However you get there, we don't care. And you're removing then any use for a peremptory challenge beyond that. You're removing the state remedy is what you're doing.
And where does the state remedy come from, other than case law?
Statute. This court's decision in McCrander is what interprets the peremptory challenge statute. And it interprets it to say you get these challenges to be used not for cause, independent of cause rulings. So that brings me to the point that I think stare decisis has to carry the day because the statute hasn't changed. What vehicle is the government proposing, even if you wanted to, that you use to get there? You have already said the rule is unassailable. There is nothing different between the feds, any of the state authority that they're offering you, that would call that into question.
Well, let me take a run at this again. So it seems to me, McCrander says that this is a statutory provision adopted by the General Assembly for the purpose of allowing an inquiry, since individuals do make a difference, and make a difference in decision making, who these people are that compose a jury that will try the defendant. Of course, the prosecution has this reciprocal right as well. But that is such an extraordinary choice for the legislature to make, that needs to be preserved, has been preserved in our jurisprudence. And the reason for the automatic reversal rule is to enforce that statutory policy.
Yes.
Right? Now, can you think of any other substantial rights that the General Assembly has enacted in the criminal law field that has that kind of stature? This goes to the fabric, let's say, of how Colorado does its community activity of judging the, let's say, the prosecution's case, since the prosecution has the burden of proof.
Are you asking me why we don't apply traditional harmless error analysis?
Yes, in essence, but I'm asking you to redefine and remind us why the General Assembly would have favored such an approach that has such an effect. I think the discussion regarding the way the feds do it is fairly interesting, that we don't allow counsel to inquire into the personal predilections and backgrounds of a member of the community who's been put in a jury pool and sitting there waiting to serve.
The reasons stated over and over by this court are because a peremptory challenge is, while not a constitutional right and not standing in its stead, goes for the purpose of achieving on top of this challenge for cause, no challenge for cause jury, a more balanced, impartial jury. And the reason I think that it is not amenable to what the government wants to, the ultimate end run, which is, well, but you got this impartial jury, so why do we care? You got what the Constitution, anyway, entitles you. And the reason is, I don't think you can apply these fund of evidence analyses to the process of selecting the jurors who are going to then be deciding the fund of evidence. You can't just come back and say, well, all was fair, like the concurrence in Novotny did. Well, there was compelling evidence and the jury was unquestionably impartial. It wasn't under our statute, because what we recognize is that in any given case, who I might want to excuse is going to change. So if a like in this case, Trump or Harris doesn't excuse an employee of a law enforcement agency, he gets excused by defense counsel. So next person coming down the pike is a victim's advocate. In a sex assault case, I sure don't want her. That's my individual perception that I get to make. If I have a client who's a juvenile theft defendant, well, that individual perception matters. So it matters to us in the state that we get a jury that appears fair by our perceptions, as well as is fair by the acid test of the challenge for cause statute. I see my time is...
Can I ask a question? Do you think that because of the Miranda rule, the dynamics of jury selection has changed at all? I mean, how it's conducted, the purpose of it?
I think the short answer, Your Honor, has changed from what? I mean, McCrander is what all of us know. It's all anybody knows. Could you be more specific?
Well, do you think, I guess change maybe is, do you think it impacts how jury selection is conducted by the lawyers and by the court?
If what you're saying is, what I think the government somehow intimates, that defendants who otherwise get a fair trial get a windfall, no. I don't think that that is a tactical consideration that anybody going in and trying to pick a fair jury to get a good result.
But do you think that the purpose always is to try and get a fair jury, or do you think sometimes they're trying to build in error because they know that there's this automatic reversal, and that affects how jury selection is conducted?
I don't think anyone's trying. I don't know of any defense counsel who would put his eggs in the basket of success on appeal. I think.
But isn't it the most commonly reversed?
Here's what they said in Merrow. And I don't know what the statistics are, but I thought Merrow was slightly inconsistent because. Because on the one hand, they said these issues are raised quite often, but the vast majority are not reversed. And what the Court of Appeals ended up doing is decrying a problem that really doesn't exist because they misunderstand the law that applies. So I don't know how much they're reversed. I think error happens in jury selection. And under our system, when error happens and a defendant is harmed, meaning his substantial rights are impacted, then the rule kicks in and there's a remedy for that.
Can you get to the other question, so we don't run you out of the chance to do that?
Yes. My basic argument on that is, I think, pretty simple in a nutshell. This court has defined in Ma and again in Speer that the Attorney General is a law enforcement agency. And they have done so using it as a prototype in Speer when crafting the precise definition to be used in this precise statute. So as I am understanding those decisions, the way, and other decisions that say, no, we don't go into duties. So what it essentially is you look at the agency, and if the agency, as has been defined here as law enforcement, is law enforcement, then he's out. That's just the end of the inquiry. You don't look what duties he has. And I think what the government is doing is sort of turning that inside out. So take, for example, where you have one that isn't contested in this case. This Denver District Attorney's Office, law enforcement agency. Under the law, jurors out. Under the government's application, it's, well, wait a minute. Let's just go down further and see if we can parse something out of that. But like for
well, isn't the primary purpose test the nexus here, though? No?
Not once you know that. This court has already said that this is a law enforcement agency. Similarly in Ma, where you're defining agency to get to the jury that your jury that is fair in fact and appearance. So where you know it, then you don't need to go there. It's been defined as that, you're done. Where the answer is no, like in Ma, then you can go further. And you can say, okay, but this little microcosm is clearly police. And in order to promote that definition of agency to comport with the statute, then we'll, call that a subdivision and law enforcement. But you don't say, well, it's law enforcement, but let's just parse out what we can, because then that necessarily devolves into duties. And, well, you're just a secretarial staff, or, well, you're the janitor. And we have 30 years of law that says we don't do that. So we have a question answered, and it's answered by this court, and the jurors should have been excused. The trial court absolutely did not need to go into any of the inquiry it did.
May I phrase that just a little differently to get you to respond? It seemed to me that the question as raised by the prosecution here is that our case law seems to have dealt with the question of figuring out things that at least have been undesignated by the legislature in terms of whether their primary purpose is criminal law enforcement. We seem to have recognized that the legislature has designated some things law enforcement agencies. Apropos of Justice Marcus's question earlier, I guess the question that seems to me to be posed by prosecution's argument is, can the legislature be wrong? Or are we saying that something is a law enforcement agency for purposes of challenges for cause, either if the legislature has designated them such, or if even undesignated, they have a primary purpose of criminal law enforcement?
Well, both, I think. But here, we don't need to go into that primary purpose inquiry because this court has done it for us. Does that make sense?
And when you say this court has done it, you mean this court has indicated at least that the legislature has designated in various places the Attorney General as a law enforcement agency.
Yes.
You're not saying we have done an analysis and found that the primary purpose of the Attorney General's office under the Speer-Mott type analysis is criminal law enforcement.
The only question, the only way I think, Your Honor, it could be more clear that it is if the actual question in Speer and Ma was, is the Attorney General law enforcement? But when this court crafted that definition, including to limit it only to criminal law enforcement, this court said, using these designated governmental bodies as prototypes, we have inferred that the legislature intended to include them within our definition.
Because they have been so designated. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay.
Ms. Karras, can I follow up on that? Believe it or not, I'm sympathetic to the trial judge in this, and no one raised that to the trial judge. No one pointed that out. That's hard.
And I think
I mean, just both sides just argued, well, he is, he, no, he isn't, yes, he is.
I think that objection was very adequately preserved, and it was very adequately preserved because here's what happens. He says, raises his hand, yes, I'm law enforcement. And then he says who he works for. And then an objection is made saying, hey, he's law enforcement. The trial judge in this case was not at all confused or in the dark. The trial judge took that bull by the horns and said, no. I know what the attorney general does. I know exactly what he does. And there's so many other different functions. And let me tell you what all he can be doing. And then he denied the challenge. So I don't think this was a question of him, you know, not knowing what was hitting him. I think this case also illustrates, you know, if there is any problem at all with this McCrander rule that has been working in this state for 100 years, it's that it's not with the rule, it's with the implementation. And in a situation like this, the obvious response is, when in doubt, as this court has repeatedly said, you kick it. Instead of fighting about it, instead of asking what duties he does, you just get rid of him and call somebody else in. Is that answer?
All right. Thank you, Ms. Grash.
Any further questions? Thank you, Ms. Grash. We'll give you another minute and 20 seconds to add to your time, Ms. Jones.
Thank you. Now, the statute provides for 5 challenges for each side. That's all that the statute provides. McCrander determined what that meant. But when it did so, it only had before it Ross. It didn't have the benefit of Martinez-Salazar or Rivera. It didn't, and Ross didn't answer the question that was really before McCrander, which is really the question that the court answered in Martinez-Salazar. And the court didn't decide to reject the United States Supreme Court case law in this matter. Instead, what the court did was distinguish Ross based on its facts. The fact that there they were looking at whether or not there was a Sixth Amendment violation. And the fact that Oklahoma law is different than Colorado law because they specifically required a defendant to use a peremptory challenge in a curative fashion. But again, had the court had Martinez-Salazar in front of it at the time, there's no reason why the court wouldn't follow the United States Supreme Court case law in this area and the development of the law in this area. Really, these peremptory challenges should be used as a means of securing a fair and impartial jury. If the defendant has to use one of his peremptory challenges to cure a for-cause error, there's no problem with that. And the defendant still has the opportunity to use his remaining challenges to shape the jury based on whatever hunches he may have.
Ms. Jones, could I ask you, if we were to agree with your and adopt the U.S. Supreme Court's approach to peremptory challenges and the effect of it, what effect would that have on a case like Lefebvre?
Well, I'll be happy to talk more about that later, since that issue will be coming up. But again, I think you're not looking at a situation in Lefebvre where the defendant was denied a right. He received everything that he was entitled to under the statute. Now, of course, the argument is going to be made that the prosecution received something extra. The prosecution, in effect, received an extra peremptory challenge, and that in some way, this impacted the defendant. I don't know what that way is, because quite frankly, the subject juror was dismissed for cause. The jury that tried the case, again, was fair and impartial. The defendant received a fair and impartial jury, a sound verdict. There was no error.
So is the effect of what you're saying that even if we were to depart from the McCrander rationale, that would not necessarily cause us to overturn Lefebvre?
Well, I think there's no problem with, I mean, yes, I think. again, I don't think that there is a problem in Lefebvre under the United States Supreme Court case law. Because again, what we're talking about is whether or not the defendant ultimately received a fair and impartial jury. To the extent that the prosecution received an extra peremptory challenge, that state error does not rise to the level of due process and should not mandate a new trial when the defendant, in fact, received a trial by a fair and impartial jury.
Okay.
The court has no further questions. I'd ask this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and affirm the defendant's conviction.
Thank you. I want to thank both attorneys for your arguments and briefs. The case will be submitted on briefs, and we'll take